Welcome to Thoughts on Record, official podcast of the Ottawa Institute of Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. Each episode, we explore topics of interest to clinicians and mental health consumers from a cognitive behavioral perspective. I'm your host, Dr. Pete Kelly. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. Dr. Alan Francis, MD, is Professor Emeritus and former Chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at Duke University School of Medicine. Dr. Francis was the Chairman of the DSM-IV Task Force and a member of the Leadership Group for DSM-III and DSM-III Revised. He is the author of the award-winning international bestseller Saving Normal, as well as Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump, and the reference work Essentials of Psychiatric Diagnosis. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Francis. I really appreciate you making the time to speak with me today. How are you doing?
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, let me just start by saying that, like so many other people, I'm really a huge fan of your 2013 book, Saving Normal. Despite its immense international popularity, I'm still shocked by the number of clinicians I come across that have not heard of it or read it. Personally, I think it's mandatory reading for anyone in mental health or related fields. For example, I recently gave a talk to a number of insurance plan sponsors in Canada, and a large part of that talk was walking them through the Saving Normal narrative around diagnostic inflation and associated issues. It's just so obvious to me that so many who could benefit from being aware of the story are really quite still in the dark. So I thought we would start by framing up the problem. Appreciating that this is a very big question, why is it so complicated to determine what is normal versus what is not in the context of mental illness?
Well, the problem is that there's a very fuzzy boundary, and that emotions that are distressing and in some ways impairing happen to be there. We have these emotions because they're also very useful. So a person who's unable to experience anxiety is going to get into terrible trouble. We see that with our president. He didn't experience enough anxiety about COVID, and then today he's announced that he's positive. That anxiety, even though it may be unpleasant, protects you from dangers. If you don't feel sadness about losses, you're not going to do the things necessary to prevent those losses, and so on. So that lots of distressing emotions that we might prefer not to have serve a very useful function. And the boundary between what becomes clinically significant mental disorder and what's the average wear and tear, everyday distress, that boundary is unclear. And it's been expanded, and the mental disorder part of it has been radically expanded over the course of the last 100 years or so. And where in the old days, only the most dramatic presentations of human distress and dysfunction would be considered mental disorder. The way diagnosis has been conceived, the way patients experience distress, the way doctors give out pills, have all resulted in a tremendous expansion of what's considered mental disorder. So at this point, somewhere between 20 and 25% of the general population might be considered to have a mental disorder in any given year, and 50% lifetime. This shows a tremendous expansion of what's considered to be mental disorder. And the tragedy of this is that it's been accompanied by two terrible consequences. One is that people who don't really need psychiatric medication are taking it. Something like 20% of the population is taking a psychiatric medicine at any given time. At the same time, we have the people who really do need help being terribly neglected. So that probably about 5% of the population has a severe mental illness. And these people really do need help. They do need medication. They do need support in the community. They do need regular follow-up. Resources are being misallocated away from the people who really need those resources and the medication toward people who don't need the medication. And often the results of the treatment are more harmful than helpful. So we have a kind of misapplied focus. We're not taking care of the people who really need help. We're over-labeling, stigmatizing, and over-treating people who really would be doing much better on their own.
I certainly want to follow up on a few of those issues. I want to back up just a little bit. For many clinicians, diagnostic frameworks like the DSM are often regarded as definitive, having an almost like canonical-like quality to them. For example, we often hear of the DSM referred to as like the Bible of mental health. Can you tell the listener a little bit about the history of the DSM and maybe some of the elements like the politics or the potential influence of pharma that shaped its development so that people can be thinking a little bit more critically about this diagnostic framework and perhaps every diagnostic framework?
Well, I started working on DSMs in 1977 or 78. And when we were doing DSM-3, no one expected it to have the enormous impact it did, not just on the professions, but also on the public. And almost immediately, people started calling it a Bible, which was absolutely ridiculous. It was meant to be, should be regarded as a guideline. And the diagnoses that were selected for DSM-3 and 3R and the criteria that would define each of the diagnoses, these were based on expert consensus, people sitting around the room shooting off ideas. There was very little information then, and there really still is very little information on the optimal way of defining each disorder and which disorder should be in the manual, which should not. DSM-3 was an expansive document, so that it had the approach of if we can define a group of patients, we should include who have a certain meet certain criteria, we should include this in the diagnostic system. There was much more concern about missing patients than there was about mislabeling people. And that happens whenever you put experts together. I've worked with thousands and thousands of experts in the field of psychiatric diagnosis. They never say my particular area is too loosely defined and we're mislabeling people who don't belong. They always worry about mispatients. Experts always have their pet diagnoses that they want to expand. When I took over the efforts for DSM-4 in the, I guess it was 1987, I saw my goal as trying to stabilize the system so it wouldn't continue growing, that the diagnostic inflation was ever expanding. And we set up very high thresholds for making changes. So we had 94 suggestions for new diagnoses, and we accepted only two. We tried to keep the expansion from getting out of hand, but we set up a goal of lots of empirical evidence before making changes. And that cut both ways. It helped to prevent the system growing, but it prevented us from cutting it back, because if there weren't a lot of empirical evidence for a cutback, we couldn't do it, and usually there wasn't. DSM-5 went overboard in the other direction of giving the people working on it a blank slate, an invitation to be creative, and so it introduced a number of changes that would further the diagnostic inflation. And I think what needs to be done now is a realization across the field. It's not just psychiatry, that 80% of psychotropic drugs are given out by primary care doctors. So psychiatrists contribute to diagnostic inflation, but generally they're referred the more severely ill people who need medicine. Most of the medicines given to people don't need it. It's particularly true of the benzodiazepines, and the 90% of the benzodiazepines are given by primary care doctors. 80% of antidepressants are given by primary care doctors. 60% of stimulants by primary care doctors, and half the antipsychotics. So particularly for benzos and for antidepressants, but really for all psychiatric drugs, there's a problem within psychiatry, that's for sure. But the bigger problem is in primary care, where a patient comes in with feelings of distress. The doctor, at this point, the GP usually only has about 10 or 15 minutes with the patients and lots of records to also fill. And so what happens is, to get the person out of the office happy, the easiest reflex is to write a prescription. And for most of the people receiving that prescription, the symptoms would probably be transient, might disappear by themselves. But once you get the medicine for it, you may misattribute the gain to the medicine, not to the healing effects of time. And people get on medicine that they don't need and then often stay on it for a very long time. And with the benzos, and particularly the benzos, but also the antidepressants, there can be withdrawal symptoms if you try to stop. And it tends to be the misattribution that if you get symptoms when you're trying to stop, it's a recurrence of illness rather than withdrawal from the medication. So people are stuck on medication they never needed in the first place, often for very, very, very long periods of time. So the idea of the book, the teaching that needs to be learned but hasn't been, is that there should be a great deal more caution in diagnosis and in giving out medication, that this should be a step process, that watchful waiting, the milder the symptoms, the more likely they are to go away with time, the less likely they are to require medication. The difference between active med and placebo is negligible for mild symptoms. The risks of the medication side effects overwhelming any benefit become greater and greater. So the basic message for primary care doctors especially, but also for psychiatrists, is to be much more cautious in making diagnoses and much more cautious in adding on medications, to avoid polypharmacy, to give patients informed consent so that they know about all the risks, not just the possible benefits, that medicine should be a last resort, not a first reflex. On the other hand, we are not taking care of the people who are really sick. They don't have access to medication. And the paradox is that if you're really sick, you can't get a pill. If you're not really sick, it's almost impossible to avoid getting a pill.
So I have a question for you from your the lens of being a practicing psychiatrist for many, many years. How have you navigated the line between eliminating pain that is really only in the service of suffering versus allowing people to connect with the necessary pain of life in order to, you know, course correct or connect and address with real underlying problems in their life, like being in an unhappy job or a marriage or a set of circumstances? How do you personally think through that when you're sitting with a client in front of you?
Well, I think the main things to be mindful of are severity of the symptoms, duration, how persistent they've been, how pervasive they are, how much is this the result of a stressor in the environment that if dealt with may result in clear-cut improvement, how classic are the symptoms to the descriptions in the manual. And it's always a good idea to underdiagnose. That it's very easy to give a label, it's very hard to take one away. That once a label gets into a chart, it tends to take on a life of its own and be haunting. So that I believe in a step diagnostic process where you're cautious in assuming that the symptoms you're seeing now are representative of the patient's long-term functioning. People look remarkably different on second visits. Watchful waiting is often the very best approach to the patient in the room. It feels hard to do because you may not get paid unless you have a diagnosis for the insurance company. The patient may be unhappy if they don't get an immediate pill or other intervention that will make them feel they got something from the visit. But I think if people take the time, if clinicians take the time to explain to patients that we have to really evaluate this carefully before jumping to a diagnosis. We have to understand how much it may be the result of external factors that need to be addressed rather than a pill solution that may make you feel better overnight, but in the long run may cause a lot more harm than good because the side effects are cumulative over time, whereas you may not really need it because so many symptoms disappear in just a few weeks if you're able to ride the storm and also figure out what are the causes. There's way too little referral to psychotherapy amongst primary care doctors and psychiatrists. That many of the problems that people present with will go away on their own, but very often psychotherapy, advice, support, normalization will be all that's needed. And psychotherapy is a tremendous bargain. That a short course of psychotherapy will often be as effective as medication and much less expensive in the long run, because once the medication starts, it often, most people, at least half people, tend to stay on it for a long period of time, much longer than they would have needed. So the message again to clinicians is to not jump to conclusions, to diagnostically be cautious, to underdiagnose. It's very hard to do a good psychiatric diagnosis in one meeting. It's impossible to do in 10 or 15 minutes if you're a primary care doctor, that the person may look completely different in the next visit. It's particularly hard to diagnose kids and the elderly. Kids change very much from visit to visit. Developmental factors may be crucial. It's striking that the best predictor of ADHD in a kid is his birthday. That if he's the youngest kid in the class, he may be almost twice as likely to get a diagnosis as the oldest kid in the class. And clearly that shows that we've turned immaturity into a mental disorder and that we're not alive to the social context when pills are prescribed. So the main message of two main messages of saving normal. The first is to save normal, to not jump into making DSM diagnoses until the picture is clinically clear and the symptoms clearly follow the pattern. They're severe. They cause distress. They don't respond to time, to psychotherapy. And that medicine should, again, always be a last reflex, a last resort, not a first reflex. And again, that we should be then focusing our attention on the people who are really sick.
You mentioned ADHD just a second ago. What are some of the diagnoses that you feel are sort of most out of control from that diagnostic inflation perspective?
Well, major depressive disorder is often not major, not depressive, and not disorder. That DSM-3, going back 40 years, made, I think, its most serious mistake in lumping together under one category the most severe depressions, which are as terrible as any human affliction. Person can't move, terribly agitated, can't think. The people with severe depression have as much suffering and dysfunction as any condition can ever possibly inflict on a person. On the other hand, lumped with major depressive disorder, people who are very close to having just a bad couple of weeks from external troubles. Previously, there was a separation between endogenous depression, which tended to have lots of body symptoms and severe cognitive deficits and real terrific inability to function. Lumping that with reactive depression, which was more the everyday troubles that come from experiencing losses and disappointments. And these were lumped together under major depressive disorder. And the minor depressions were mischaracterized as being major. So what happened was a tremendous expansion in the numbers of people who got the diagnosis major depressive disorder. And the drug companies were able, through intensive advertising 20 years ago, 25 years ago, to convince people that this was major depressive disorder was always a chemical imbalance and required a chemical solution in the pill. So I think that of all the overdiagnoses that result in excessive use of pills, something like 25% of women over 40 in America are taking an antidepressant. And this comes from that kind of confounding of severe clinical depression with the sadness and disappointments and grief of everyday life. I think that the second biggest area of overdiagnosis amongst the anxiety disorders and phobias, again, anxiety being a useful response. Like one of the a paper was published in the last couple of weeks saying that the rates of depression had tripled because of COVID. And this is a typical and egregious example of the diagnostic inflation. Of course, people are feeling sad and anxious because of COVID, but that doesn't mean they have a clinical mental disorder. Feeling sad and anxious because of COVID is a perfectly normal evolutionary response. The people who aren't sad and anxious because of COVID are the abnormal ones. We shouldn't be labeling these evolutionarily built-in adaptive emotions as evidence of mental disorder. And again, people like Trump who aren't able to experience anxiety in relation to a deadly pandemic are doomed to suffer the consequences of it. We don't want to be labeling anxiety about COVID that has people wearing masks as a mental disorder. And even in the less dramatic states where we don't have COVID as a threat, there's been a tendency to overdiagnose anxiety conditions as mental disorders, and many of them are perfectly normal adaptations to a very, very uncertain current world situation, and for many people, a terribly devastating economic situation which doesn't have any easy answers. There's been a tremendous overdiagnosis of somatic disorders. The great example, again, from COVID is that many people who had chronic fatigue syndromes were misdiagnosed as having a mental disorder. The default position has tended to be that if it couldn't be explained medically, therefore it must be psychiatric. And they are terribly stigmatized by this, furious about it, It reduces the medical care they get because there's a quick jump to it's a psychiatric problem, and sometimes forces them into stigmatizing situations where they or family members are led to believe it's all in their head when really they're feeling terrible symptoms and incapacity to function physically. We're seeing that the long haulers with COVID are having those exact symptoms. And this, I think, has impressed on people the fact that many unexplained medical disorders are unexplained just because we don't understand them. And because they're unexplained doesn't mean that they're psychiatric. It shouldn't be seen as a default position. There are lots of people who've been given disorders, sexual disorder diagnoses, that have been dreamed up by drug companies trying to peddle pills. And all across the manual, especially recently with DSM-5, grief is being misdiagnosed. Normal grief is being misdiagnosed as major depressive disorder. The tendency has been to label as mental disorder all of the distresses and dysfunctions of life. And recently, especially again with Trump, there's been a tendency to label bad behavior as being psychiatric. In the United States, we have a big problem with rapists being called mentally disordered, even though the profession has tried very hard to make clear that rape is a crime, not a mental disorder. It's used in the courts to keep people incarcerated after their prison sentences are up. And with Trump, there's been an effort to say that he's mentally ill, and that's the reason why he does all of these terrible things. And that the problem with Trump is not so much a political one as a medical one, and that he should be removed from office based on the 25th Amendment, which says that if you're medically unfit, the vice president of the cabinet can remove you from office. Trump is a very evil person and needs to be understood in those terms and in political terms for the dangers he represents, and he needs to be defeated politically. It's not appropriate to be mislabeling his bad behavior as mental illness, and this has several terrible unintended consequences. One is that it's a great stigma for the mentally ill, most of whom are really nice people who are well-behaved and well-meaning. For them to be lumped with Trump is an insult to them because he's neither well-behaved nor well-meaning, and it gives people the false impression that mentally ill people are dangerous. Because if Trump is mentally ill and he's dangerous, that must mean that it carries over to others. Most mentally ill people suffer from other people's violence, but don't commit violence themselves. And it's stigmatizing for them to be lumped with Trump. It also misses the point that if you're hoping for a medical relief from Trump, that's never going to come. And it distracts us from having to beat him at the ballot box. And so I think that in general, there's been the fuzzy boundary between normality and mental illness has been unfortunately breached in the direction of increasing the realm of mental illness and reducing the realm of normality. And the boundary between bad behavior and mental illness has also been so fuzzy that there's a tendency now to say that anyone who does anything bad, a mass murderer, a rapist, anyone who does something bad must have a mental illness. And again, that distracts us from and stigmatizes the people who have severe mental illness, who really, we do understand severe mental illness. We have very long clinical experience with it. We have treatments that, you know, aren't perfect, but are quite effective. And we have to focus our efforts on the people who we can really help the most, not be distracted by the people essentially normal or people who are essentially bad, where we have very, very little to offer.
Well, those are such wonderful points, and I think there's a number of clinicians listening that would hold similar grievances around all the issues that you raised. With all the benefit of hindsight, if you could design a diagnostic framework from the ground up, you know, what would be your personal guiding framework around this? And I guess maybe just adding a thought to that is like, you know, how realistic is it to do better than the basic DSM framework? Or do you think all things considered is actually pretty good and serves a useful purpose?
Well, when I was first appointed, for a few hours, I began thinking, well, what should I do with this system? Now that you're at the head of it, maybe you can make it much better. But I realized, first of all, no one person can ever have that big an impact because it's a system that the buy-ins have to be from so many different stakeholders. It's not as if any one person can come and say, oh, I want to do it this way. And I realized that my job was going to be to corral it, to make it less likely that it would expand rather than I could just wipe out diagnoses I didn't like. There was lots in DSM-3 I didn't like, but I realized it would not be appropriate, be arbitrary for me to say, okay, I don't like this, we're going to get rid of it. That you have to be able to establish consensus, and you have to be able to have empirical evidence for making changes. I think that we're stuck with the system. DSM-5, I think, is way over-inclusive. But it's not as if anyone's going to come and say with DSM-6, okay, we're going to make it right. It's just not going to happen. It may be that DSM-6 will make it even worse. It's certainly not going to be that DSM-6, if it ever happens, is going to just eliminate all the problematic areas. I think it's more realistic to try to warn clinicians. The DSM is just a clinical guide. It's fallible. It's subjective. The criteria sets are not, you know, they were arbitrarily developed and not written in stone. And that unless you have very clear-cut symptoms that are characteristic of a severe mental disorder, everything else is much more up for grabs. And rather than jumping towards a diagnosis and acting as if it's definite and it calls for this one treatment, particularly that treatment's medication, people should be a lot more cautious in using the system. ADHD, when we started work on DSM-3, had a rate of about maybe 3% in the population. And now, largely, partly because of changes in the DSMs, but largely because of drug company advertising and the convenience for parents and school systems, now the rate may be 12%. It's quadrupled in the last 30 years. And this makes no sense. The father of ADHD, Keith Connors, who died a couple of years ago, thought that the true rate of ADHD is 2 or 3%. And instead, it's being diagnosed in 12% of the population. So if I'm a parent, I'm not going to jump to think that because my kid's having trouble in school and is boisterous in the classroom, I'm not going to jump and say, oh, this must be ADHD. If I'm a teacher, I won't be thinking that all the problems in the classroom are coming from ADHD, especially if I know that it's the most immature kids in the class. The youngest kids in the class are causing the most trouble. It's not as if the classroom chaos is due to a mental disorder. It's due to the fact that we have too many kids in the class and some of them are immature. That gives you a different perspective on what the intervention should be. It makes you see it more as an educational problem than a mental health problem. And certainly if I'm a pediatrician or a child psychiatrist, I'm not going to jump on the first signs of distractibility and inattentiveness and slap an ADHD diagnosis on 12% of all kids and 20% of teenage boys. I'm going to be more careful to check out other possible ways of understanding this that are more contextual in terms of the level of maturity of the kid, birthday, the classroom situation that he's in, whether we can do training for the parents and the teachers and setting limits in a way, whether working more by computer will improve performance, all kinds of things that can be done that have to do with the environment, the psychology of the situation, the educational constraints, rather than jumping on a diagnosis and giving medication. I don't think we should wait for it. We're going to have a better system of diagnosis. That may never happen. I think it's more how we use the system we have now and to be much more selective in its use. I hate to plug a book, but I did a book called Essentials of Psychiatric Diagnosis that gives a framework for using the DSM in each category to try to be much more aware of the risks of giving the diagnosis and less enthralled by the benefits. That each of the DSM mental disorders is a suggestive guideline. But if we use it in an expansive way, we're going to include, mislabel many people who would be better off not getting that label. And I think that the goal should be to use these categories in a very restrictive way where the diagnosis is given only after everything else has been tried first, and watchful waiting, advice, normalization, and psychotherapy haven't worked. The diagnosis shouldn't be the first step in the process. It should come after all these other things have had some chance to work. The insurance companies make that very difficult or impossible, and that's one of the problems, that forcing a doctor to make a diagnosis after a first visit means that they're going to overdiagnose. And many of the things they diagnose will have disappeared in a few weeks. Maybe the thing they diagnose is a more severe version of the explanation of the symptoms than is really necessary. If clinicians were allowed 5 sessions before making a diagnosis, it would, in the long run, be a lot cheaper and also a lot better in terms of the treatments offered, because we wouldn't have this rush to judgment. And very often, it turns out to be a treatment that's given for years and years, and a diagnosis that may last on the chart for life is based on a 10-minute evaluation in a primary care setting, where the doctor doesn't really have time to get to know the patient or to discuss with the patient the pluses and minuses of different alternatives.
Dr. Francis, that's so well said. So in Twilight of American Sanity, a psychiatrist analyzes the age of Trump. You speak quite extensively around the rise of Trump. From the perspective of a clinician, a psychiatrist specifically, could you perhaps outline one or two of the top reasons why you think Trump has been able to enjoy the relative success that he has?
Well, it's a long and lugubrious story. I think that everyone's been trying to see Trump as crazy. I think he's crazy like a fox. He's kind of like a P.T. Barnum showman, man without morals, an expert at self-promotion and at exploiting others, a kind of evil genius in propaganda, and an idiot in everything else. He's completely transparent as a personality. There may be very few people in the history of the world who are easier to understand than Trump, because he's right out there. He doesn't have the capacity to hide his worst impulses in the way most people do. So he's no mystery. The mystery is how people could vote for him, and how the book was written 3 years ago, where I predicted just about everything that's happened. And that didn't require any special genius, because Trump is Trump, and he's been the same sort of like flame out failure who's always managed to, like Phoenix, rise from the ashes of the destruction he's caused. 6 bankruptcies. He's been a terrific failure his whole life, but he always manages to land on his feet, everyone around him being destroyed. That's his particular genius. What's miraculous to me and unpredictable to me is that 40% of the population are fixated on this, and that no matter what he does in terms of serial sex abuse, tax evasion, obvious corruption of his people in terms of foreign leaders and the elections, in terms of his business dealings, the crassness, the vulgarity, the shameless lying, none of this has had any impact on the 40% who support him. And that, to me, is a great mystery. I understand greedy people who are riding Trump because he gives them tax breaks. I probably understand the white supremacist terrorist types for whom he's breathed tremendous life. I sort of understand some of the religious bigots who are willing to do anything to help fetuses, although they don't seem to care very much about the children they become. But I can't understand 40% of the American people falling for this. And the only way it makes any sense is that he was such a success on TV. A show which was hideous ran for 10 years and made him $430 million. The only money he's made probably in the last 30 years. He's lost money on everything except that show. And that there is in the American public a substantial minority of people who respond to the reality TV element, are entertained by it, somehow identify with him. And the tragedy of America is that the sort of like the worst elements in our population have controlled the narrative and the policies for these last 4 years. We've seen about a year ago, I said on TV that Trump, I thought, would be responsible for more deaths in this century than Hitler Mussolini and Stalin and Mao were in the last. And I got a lot of blowback for that. How could I possibly say that? Well, we've seen Trump now with the pandemic responsible probably in the United States for 160,000 unnecessary deaths. And this is just really a dress rehearsal of what science denial can do, that the devastation that will be wrought by climate change is a massive multiple, exponential multiple of what we're seeing now. And I think hundreds and hundreds of millions, maybe billions of people will be killed by the ravages that will come with climate change, which we're ignoring, just as he's ignored COVID. The lack of wearing a mask is a parallel to the fact that we're doing everything possible in this country to destroy any worldwide response to climate change. And while we can't blame all of the climate change problem on this one man, he certainly would be the one person in the world who has done his best to make sure that humanity faces this existential challenge without a mask, without a climate change policy that would have any hope of saving us from an absolute disaster. So I think that there's a kind of mass delusion, societal delusion, that we can go along ignoring science, ignoring the clear signs of future disaster, ignoring the fires in California, the terrible hurricanes and flooding in the southeast, ignoring what's likely to be worldwide famines and droughts, the wars that will come as resources are drained, ignoring the fact that many cities in the world will be unlivable in just 50 years because of the temperatures. We're ignoring a terrible future fate of mankind and instead watching this reality TV show. And the show, Trump's reality TV show in the White House, has gotten very good ratings with 40% of the population enjoying it enough to keep him in office. And he will cheat enough. If he beats this infection, I'm still afraid he could win despite his disastrous performance through a combination of cheating and propaganda. So I think that humanity, it's not just the United States, but humanity faces a tremendous challenge in the next month. And we have to hope that we get returned to societal sanity, because we've certainly lost our minds as a nation for these last 4 years. And so goes America, and so goes the rest of the world, especially on climate change. So you have to worry about the same things in Canada.
Well, yes, as a Canadian, we're really curious to see what's going to happen in November for sure. So very, very interesting times, to say the least, that we live in.
We may try to move up there. I hope you have a spot for me.
Absolutely.
No joke.
No, we'll make room, no problem. Dr. Francis, I really want to thank you for your time today and your insights, and for walking the listener through the Saving Normal narrative. Again, I think it's despite the massive popularity of the book, not enough people know about it. And I really appreciate you taking the time to do that today.
My pleasure. And your questions were terrific. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Have a great day, and talk to you soon.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, I really hope that you enjoyed the podcast as much as I did. If you found value in the show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. And now for the mandatory disclaimer. This podcast represents the opinions of Dr. Kelly and that of his guests. Content of the podcast should not be taken as psychological advice and is for general information only. Please consult your mental health professional for any specific questions around your psychological health. In no way does listening to our content establish a psychologist-client relationship. While we make every effort to ensure that the information we are sharing is accurate, we welcome any comments, suggestions, or corrections of errors. All people, places, and scenarios mentioned in the podcast have been changed to protect patient confidentiality. Finally, this podcast should not be used in any legal capacity whatsoever, including but not limited to establishing a standard of care in a legal sense or as a basis for expert witness testimony. No guarantee is given regarding the accuracy of any statements or opinions made on the podcast.